we finished the oil and gas special session, you know, it just kind of felt done.
The State Commissioner of Revenue steps down. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, August 1st. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, unexpected news about individual insurance rates in Alaska for next year. They're going down.
We've been very conservative and assumed that those cost-sharing reduction payments are not going to be there. And so we've worked that into the cost of the rates for next year, for 2018.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
ExxonMobil Alaska, whose goal is safe and responsible operations of the Point Thompson facility. ExxonMobil Energy lives here.
And by
Wells Fargo, with over 13,000 ATMs and more than 6,000 branches coast to coast. For a branch location near you, visit wellsfargo.com.
Finally, a bit of good news about Alaska's healthcare marketplace. Primera is projecting premiums will decrease in 2018 by about 22% for people who buy their own insurance through the government-run exchange. This news comes despite uncertainty about whether Congress will still try to change the Affordable Care Act and what action the Trump administration might take as it administers Barack Obama's signature health care law. Alaska Public Media Washington correspondent Liz Ruskin has the story.
Primera cites two reasons for the lower prices. The company saw a significant reduction among Alaska customers in the use of medical services. Also, the state's reinsurance program is now covering some high-cost claims, and the federal government has committed to fund the lion's share of that program for 5 years. The news might be a sign of stability in Alaska's health insurance market, which has the highest-priced insurance premiums in the nation. But Primera cautions against reading too much into it. The company says Alaska's market is small and remains volatile. Senator Dan Sullivan says he expected Alaska's reinsurance program would result in lower 2018 premiums in Alaska. But Sullivan says Alaska's situation doesn't solve the larger problem of insurance plans that cost too much.
Nationally, I mean, the tea leaves I'm reading, it looks like it's going to be more of the same or worse, going up.
Unlike Senator Lisa Murkowski, Sullivan supported Republican efforts last week to repeal parts of the Affordable Care Act. Those measures failed. Sullivan says he's still working hard to find a solution.
Yeah, I think we're reassessing right now.
President Trump has repeatedly suggested his administration might stop making payments to insurance companies for a subsidy known as cost-sharing reductions. CSR provides extra help to the poorest people who buy insurance on the individual market. It allows them to have lower deductibles and pay less out of pocket when they see a doctor. The government reimburses insurance companies for the difference. In Alaska, most people who use the online insurance marketplace qualify for a tax credit that lowers their premium, what they pay every month. But less than half also qualify for CSR, to lower out-of-pocket costs. Primera spokeswoman Melanie Kuhn says by law, it has to provide the CSR subsidy to people who qualify for it, even if the federal government doesn't come through with the payment. Kuhn says Primera would have to increase premiums to make up the difference. And she says they assumed that worst-case scenario when they calculated the rates.
We have assumed, we've been very conservative and assumed that those cost-sharing reduction payments are not going to be there. And so we've worked that into the cost of the rates for next year, for 2018.
She says they're still calculating what Alaska premiums would be if the CSR is paid. They would almost certainly be lower still. Senator Sullivan says he thinks the government should keep providing the CSR money.
I don't want people to get hurt, right? So I would be supportive of making those payments.
The chairman of the Senate Health Committee says he plans to begin bipartisan hearings on health care in September. Reporting from Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
Randall Hofbeck announced today he's resigning as Commissioner of Revenue on August 17th in order to return to the ministry. The 59-year-old commissioner has often served as the governor's point person on how to close the state's budget gap. Governor Bill Walker says he reluctantly accepted the resignation. Deputy Commissioner Jerry Burnett will be interim commissioner until Walker names a replacement. Hofbeck says he wants to spend more time with his father, who has Parkinson's disease, as well as his two grandchildren.
When we finished the oil and gas special session, you know, it just kind of felt done. The energy wasn't there, and there's a lot of other things that were tugging me other directions, and I just finally really felt that it was time for me to go back to focusing on a calling to ministry and really where I was headed before this job came along.
Hofbeck completed seminary in 2014.
I've never been a pastor, per se, and that's something that's ahead of me in my career path, not behind me.
Hofbeck worked on some of Walker's key proposals, including a plan to use money from permanent fund earnings to pay for state government. Hofbeck says he'll continue to work with Walker until his last day on a proposal for a new tax to help close the gap between what the state government spends and what it raises. Longtime Kodiak Republican Senator Gary Stevens will run for lieutenant governor in 2018. For now, he's the first to file for that position. Stevens has spent almost 18 years in the Alaska legislature. Before that, he was a familiar face in Kodiak's local government. He served as mayor of both the Kodiak Island Borough and the city of Kodiak, and was also school board president. Stevens has been in the Senate since 2004 and previously served as a member of the Alaska House of Representatives. He says it's been in the back of his mind to run for the position of lieutenant governor. Now that he's in the first year of a four-year term, he says he's in a good position to do it.
If I win, great. If I lose, I'll spend two more years in the Senate. So either way, I have a friend who used to always say, send me to Juneau or send me fishing. Either way I win. I sort of feel that way, too. You know, either way, I'd much appreciate the opportunity of being a lieutenant governor. If that doesn't happen, I'll spend a couple more years in the Senate.
Stevens expresses flexibility about working with the goals and needs of whoever wins the position of governor.
Giving the governor your input and your impression of how things should work or may work or can work is really, really important. And that's varied. Sometimes we've had lieutenant governors that have not been able to work with the governor at all. And sometimes we've had governors and lieutenant governors who have been a very fine team. That's the main thing. And it's really up to the governor in that case to figure out how best to use the lieutenant governor.
He also says Alaska is struggling with its election process. He says soon the state will need to replace its ballot counting machines and could look toward an alternative method. He says some of the western states, like Colorado, have found success with mail-in ballots. Stephen says the healthcare system, oil and gas, state resources, and international business remain primary focuses moving forward. For the second year in a row, there will be no commercial fishing on the Kuskokwim. Larry Lang, owner of the processing vessel Accutan, says the bank will not lend him the money needed to buy silver salmon this summer. Lang was the only buyer registered with the state to purchase Kuskokwim salmon this year. He was scheduled to anchor in Kuskokwim Bay this week. The last time there was a commercial opening on the Kuskokwim in 2015, nearly 400 fishermen participated. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the effect of too few food safety inspectors in the state.
I've been out to rural communities where I've been just scared. Like, I know, my gosh, it's been so long since we've been out here.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
First National Bank Alaska. For nearly a century, First National has been Alaska's community bank. Learn how experience and local knowledge make the difference at fnbalaska.com.
Outside of Anchorage, the state's food safety and sanitation program is responsible for inspecting restaurants, pools, spas, tattoo parlors, food processors, and other facilities. But after several years of state budget cuts, fewer inspectors are paying fewer visits, especially to rural Alaska. KTOO's Carter Barrett reports the check-ins are intended to protect public health, but some places haven't been visited for years.
Salmon patties sizzle on the grill at the Salmon Spot, a new addition to Juneau's many downtown seasonal food stands. Their license hangs just above a box of plastic gloves. With food inspectors available in town, navigating the permits and getting open for business was a lot of work, but not impossible. The seasonal stands in Juneau are inspected regularly. In the western Aleutian island of Adak, there are only two full-service restaurants. The federal government considers restaurants high risk and recommends food safety regulators inspect them 4 times a year. But none of the restaurants in Adak have been inspected in over 4 years. In 2013, the Aleutian Sports Bar and Grill was cited for rodent droppings and storing food in the kitchen restroom, among other violations. It's since closed its kitchen. In Alaska, inspections are creeping further apart. High-risk facilities are inspected on average once every 18 to 24 months. In rural areas, it can be even longer. Here's Food Safety and Sanitation Program Manager Kimberly Stryker.
The number of inspection staff at this point would probably need to triple or maybe even quadruple for us to be able to get out with any degree of adequacy.
In 2016, half of high-risk retail food establishments were inspected. How frequently Food Safety and Sanitation inspects a facility is based on an assessment that factors in proximity to their offices, the concentration of high-risk facilities, if it is a hub community with access to smaller villages, among other criteria.
Once you go outside of those larger communities, you're really talking about much more expensive travel.
A round-trip Anchorage to Adak plane ticket is $1,200, and there's only one flight a week. Over the last 3 years, lawmakers have cut over $1 million from Food Safety and Sanitation's budget. Two offices have closed, and a fifth of the staff has been cut.
I would say that overall, it's resulted in a reduction in our capacity to be able to prevent and respond to illness outbreaks.
The Federal Food and Drug Administration funds contracts to inspect facilities that sell food across state lines, usually large processing plants. The state uses these trips to inspect other nearby facilities as well. The state also raised the fees facilities must pay to make up for lost funds. Jason Wired is an environmental health officer based in Juneau.
Really, really disgusting.
And that's his Scooby-Doo ringtone. It's part of his job to conduct inspections.
We're like a puppy dog chasing our tail, so that's just what we do. We're never caught up. It gets a little stressful. It gets a little tough.
Part of the job is being gone for a week or more on trips.
You might be sleeping in places that would surprise you. You could be sleeping on a gym floor in a clinic. Yeah, you could be sitting at an airport, you know, all night because there's no lodging.
Staff turnover is common in food safety and sanitation because of tough working conditions and budget layoffs. According to the most recent CDC data, 2015 was Alaska's worst year for foodborne illnesses and hospitalizations since the tracking began in 1998. There were 234 reported illnesses and 31 hospitalizations where the location of preparation was confirmed as restaurants.
I'm concerned about Alaskans becoming sick with foodborne illness. It is completely preventable, and it can absolutely change a person's life.
The city manager in Adak says the small-town rumor mill keeps restaurants and cooks in check. But Wired says Adak is on their schedule for the fall.
I've been out to rural communities where I've been just scared. Like, I know, my gosh, it's been so long since we've been out here. And you show up, and they're dialed in perfectly. I think everybody understands the importance of food safety. And then again, I've been to places where you walk in and it's a disaster.
There used to be a McDonald's, a movie theater, and a swimming pool on Adak. They're gone now. Just the skeletal, weathered structures are left.
When they don't see us for a lot of years, it's hard to go in there and say, you're doing all this stuff wrong. And they're like, great, where were you for the last 10 years? We'd love to hear this more often so we're not out of compliance.
In Juneau, sometimes it takes a visit to reassure food safety. In 2011, Wired closed Juneau's downtown soup kitchen, the Glory Hole.
It was awful. It was egregious. The worst thing possible in the world that I could have done. They had a lot of rodents and cockroaches.
After an overnight cleaning binge, Wired returned the next morning to see if the kitchen could reopen for breakfast.
Just the impact of being able to do that so folks down at the Glory Hole could have a breakfast that morning, that was some of the sacrifices that I look at, like, yeah, that was a good thing.
In rural communities, that kind of follow-up and education aren't always possible. As for the food safety and sanitation program's budget this year, it didn't lose any more funding. In Juneau, I'm Carter Barrett.
Warming in the southern Beaufort Sea is leading to some surprising biological changes for the region's polar bears. But recent findings related to the bear's health warns of other challenges coming down the line. From Alaska's Energy Desk, Elizabeth Jenkins has more.
When scientists go into the field to study the Beaufort Sea bears, they collect samples. And a little tuft of fur is flown all the way from the Arctic to a lab on the East Coast. Melissa McKinney hasn't seen the bears firsthand. But since 2004, she's come in contact with their hair inside a lab at the University of Connecticut. She's using it to look for mercury.
Most of the mercury that is present in the environment right now is due to human emissions.
And that mercury makes its way up the food web, first in fish and later in the ring seals that eat the fish. By the time it makes its way up to the polar bears, the mercury is super concentrated, and McKinney says it can have toxic effects. The Beaufort bears, in particular, are thought to have some of the highest levels of mercury in the Arctic. So McKinney expected to see some fluctuation in the levels over time.
That would be kind of what we would anticipate.
But over a 7-year stretch, McKinney has found that the numbers have dropped by more than half.
Well, I was surprised. I mean, I thought that we might see some variation, but I was surprised at the extent of decline that occurred over a relatively short period of time.
Which sounds like a good thing. These polar bears have much less mercury in their systems. But the information tells scientists something else.
The decline in mercury in the southern Beaufort Sea polar bears can largely be explained by changes in their diet and condition.
Instead of dining on ring seal out on the ice, more polar bears in the Beaufort Sea are coming onshore, where they're consuming bowhead whale scraps left over from subsistence hunts. McKinney says there's only so much of that food to go around.
In the short term, yes, we see this decline in terms of mercury, but what it'll mean in the long term when we have more bears on shore and more bears using that resource, we might see that this situation changes.
She says while this study is about polar bears in the Beaufort Sea, it also reveals something about us. The implications of warming are a lot more varied than we thought. From Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Elizabeth Jenkins in Juneau.
A tract of potentially mineral-rich land northeast of Fairbanks is recommended for transfer from federal to state hands. The 709-acre parcel near Fox and the Fort Knox gold mine is being relinquished by the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration near where the agency operates a satellite downlink facility. The Bureau of Land Management recently completed an environmental assessment of impacts of relinquishing the property.
We have found no potential for significant impacts from the relinquishment and transfer to the state.
Valerie Baxter with the BLM Eastern Interior Field Office says the state has selected the land, which includes mining claims held by the operator of Fort Knox.
Because it's an ANILCA state selection, if it transfers to the state, then those state mining claims will become valid.
Fort Knox has explored some of the area in recent years under BLM-issued permits. Any additional action on the property after transfer would be subject to state agency approval. Transfer of the land from the federal government to the state must be authorized by the Secretary of the Interior. Baxter says that usually takes 4 to 6 months.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Equawk Lodge hosted a subsistence use disorder recovery program last month. The vision was to teach subsistence skills as part of the regimen. KDLG's Avery Lill attended the ceremony and has the story.
The smell of soured salmon and pig muck hangs in the air, but Ben, whose name has been changed for privacy, smiles shyly as he points out the nails in wooden boards that surround the pen. The nails stick out to deter bears.
We feed them fish and other leftover foods.
For the past month, the 22-year-old, who grew up in Equawk, Dillingham, Togiak, and Anchorage, participated in a substance use disorder recovery program. The vision of the program was to teach subsistence skills as a part of the regimen. All graduates are Alaska Native, and the idea is that cultural activities can be integral to recovery. While raising pigs might not be a traditional subsistence activity in rural Alaska, these 9 smelly oinkers gave the clients ample opportunity to practice one that is fishing. The program participants set nets every day to bring in enough fish to feed the pigs. For 2 men, including Ben, this was their first time to be involved in subsistence fishing. The three men graduating from the program helped daily with the construction and maintenance on the lodge, which has been out of use. They chopped wood and carried water up to the lodge from the river. They fished for salmon to feed the pigs and to cut and smoke for themselves. They took a maché every night and cleaned themselves in the steam bath.
It's fun. Picking berries, fishing, cutting up fish, making a guruk for the berries that you picked. Taking a load off with cutting up fish, it was nice labor. I'm slowly getting used to being clean and sober and looking forward to keeping it that way.
On graduation day, more than two dozen people, family members, the local priest, and members of the Ekwok community gathered to celebrate the month that graduates have spent in recovery. There were children running in between couches and wooden chairs as the graduates stood up to receive their diplomas. The program's leaders and community members congratulated and affirmed each one individually. Several coordinators spoke of their own recovery from addiction. The graduates themselves spoke warmly of the program and about their commitment to sobriety. Ekwok Natives Limited masterminded the program and put up the funds, which were substantial. Jimmy Hurley Sr., president of ENL's board, estimates that the village corporation spent about $100,000 to cover the cost for all participants and to bring in Two-Town Recovery Services, a private business from Anchorage, to run the program.
Everybody used to put up fish, but the subsistence part, you know, it brings pride in the people. If you're a native and if you don't know how to put away salmon, I think there are a lot of embarrassment. That should be part of every recovery, bringing culture into it. Culture is really strong. We've lost so much of it, you know. So.
This is Two-Town Recovery Services' first time operating outside Anchorage or incorporating subsistence as a component of their recovery program. At a time when the governor has declared the epidemic of opioid use in Alaska a crisis, many are looking for more effective means of combating addiction. Relapse is always a concern in programs that address substance use disorder. Edie Flagary, the program director, anticipates that the subsistence component will help as clients return home.
When you find out where you came from, and then you start, you know, doing some things that you did when you were a kid, you're just like, oh, okay, I got it.
As for Ekwok Natives Limited, Hurley says that the corporation board has been supportive of this year's pilot run of the program, but the price tag is too large to continue without grants or outside funding. In the coming months, they'll explore their options for continuing the wellness camp. The graduates have all flown back to their homes in Anchorage and in Bristol Bay, hopefully to continue their journeys with sobriety. They left with smoked fish in their bags for the winter and the skills to do it again next summer. In Ekwok, I'm Avery Lill.
Malcolm Rabeau is a transgender man from Illinois who's been traveling around the U.S. for the past 9 months, helping trans men connect with one another. When his journey started, he just wanted to meet some of his many social media followers. He soon realized his network could support people as they go through gender transition and increase the visibility of the trans community. Now he's in Alaska, his 49th state. Rabeau says on one of his first meetings with an Instagram follower, he found out something unexpected.
I met someone who I found hadn't ever met another trans guy. And that was crazy to me because my reality back in Chicago was that I hung out with guys all the time. Like every weekend I would go to the city and just kind of hang out with people and be able to just have that camaraderie and that support. And during the week, I didn't have like other guys that I really hung out with because I didn't live in the city. So I felt really isolated and alone during the week. So the thought of this guy who had never even met another trans guy and he had just started his medical transition a week prior made me feel like he must feel the same way I felt, or even just a whole nother degree, you know, of isolation all the time. And I met another guy the next day who was only half an hour away and neither of them knew of each other. And it just kind of started to click that like, hey, these guys have similarities with one another. They don't know they're the guys. I started posting pictures of them online. And with my following, like, people were seeing them. And, like, it was starting to spread visibility for our community, in and out of our community. And people were starting to, like, kind of comment on the pictures and be like, hey, I didn't know you lived here. And just gradually over time, I started realizing that it was a way to connect people. So I started bringing groups of guys together and then seeing them connect in person. And that was where it really clicked. And I was just like, okay, this is what I'm supposed to be doing. Like, I'm supposed to be connecting these guys with one another and like helping show that we're all over the place, you know?
Why is it important to build connections between people going through transition?
Some of the experiences that we go through are just so specific to being transmasculine, you know, and there are things that you can't really talk about with just anybody and have them understand. So having that support of someone who really, really understands and is going through the same thing is just, it's just huge.
Malcolm, how do you think your efforts have changed the larger community's thoughts and ideas about being transgender? What kind of effects are you seeing from your travels?
I think it's helping to normalize, quote unquote, what transgender really is. I think a lot of people don't know what it is, and they have this fear of this unknown. So I feel like it's helping people to realize that we're human, you know, we're just other people, we're just people.
In Anchorage, the city is reviewing a ballot measure that would require people to only use the bathroom that corresponds with the biological sex that's on their birth certificate. You've traveled through states that have proposed similar laws. In your opinion, what would the effect of such a law be?
It's dangerous, especially for trans women. For them to be in a restroom with men, there's a lot of violence that can happen in that situation. And for trans men to be in the women's room, that could cause fear in, you know, women's. It's dangerous.
Malcolm, what advice would you give to other people who are going through a gender transition? What do you say to them?
My biggest piece of advice has always been to be patient. Patient with yourself and with others. When you're coming out to others, try to be patient with their level of understanding and kind of try to be open with how you feel and your feelings about it and give them time to come to understand it. You know, and patient with yourself as well, with all the different steps that you may plan to go through. Not everybody goes through all different types of steps that people think, you know. Not everybody has surgery. Not everybody goes on hormones. Not, you know, some people may socially transition. Some may not. Be patient, too, with the steps that it can take to get your name changed and to get on hormones and to have surgeries. And There's a lot of hoops that we have to jump through, and that can be really difficult and really trying. But in the long run, it's going to be worth it.
Rabeau plans to return to Alaska and host meetups. You can follow his travels on Gorilla Shrimp on Instagram. That's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had reports tonight from Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Andrew Kitchman, Carter Barrett and Elizabeth Jenkins in Juneau, Kayla DeRoche in Kodiak, Anna Rose MacArthur in Bethel, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Avery Lill in Dillingham, and Ann Hillman in Anchorage. Our audio engineer is Eric Bork, Wesley Early is our web editor, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Alaska Pipeline Service Company, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline since 1977. The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration provide information on passengers' rights and responsibilities. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.